with these structural threats to our democracy, because if they don't deal with it now, you can make a very good argument they're probably not going to get another chance to deal with it anytime soon.
We've been speaking with Ari Berman. The book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It's out from Picador. Find his work, including The Insurrection Was Put Down, The GOP Plan for Minority Rule Marches On, online at motherjones.com. Ari Berman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine. Good to talk to you again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Are you a KABU member? Tell us why you support KABU. Call our listener testimonial line and leave a message telling us why you support KABU Community Radio. Testimonials will be used on air during our next membership drive. Call 503-231-8032, extension 302, That's 503-231-8032, extension 302. Thanks.
You're listening to Community Radio.
KBOO, Portland.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31st, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk
Race.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race. Today our topic is racism in AI. AI, also known as artificial intelligence, has been the topic of sci-fi movie favorites like The Terminator and iRobot. Today we see examples of AI in our social media feeds, Amazon product suggestions, and Netflix recommendations. The truth is that artificial intelligence is starting a technological revolution. And while AI has yet to take over the world, there's a more pressing concern we've already encountered: AI bias. AI bias is the underlying prejudice in data that's used to create AI algorithms, which can ultimately result in racial discrimination where the algorithms are being used in industries such as healthcare and also facial recognition in law enforcement. I interviewed Junaid Wirwani, Senior Engineering Manager at Jetty in New York City, to get more insight on how AI can be biased, examples of how AI algorithms have demonstrated prejudice and discrimination, and what are some of the remedies. Junaid is the workshop's manager and advisor at the nonprofit AI for Everyone, whose vision is to see a world where each and every person has at least the basic understanding of AI and technology to become empowered to speak up when that technology has a negative impact on their lives. So thank you so much for joining the show. If you could please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your technical background.
Sure. Hi, my name is Junaid Wirwani. I am a senior engineering manager at Jetty. I have been working in tech for some time now and got introduced to the space of artificial intelligence back in college and then in some of the work I did in tech. Specifically, I spent some time working at Clarify, where we were building image recognition AI as a service. After that, I have also spent a lot of time volunteering in the nonprofit space, specifically for a nonprofit called AI for Anyone, where we go out to high schools in New York City and try to teach students a little bit about AI. During the pandemic, we've been doing some of that teaching with some online workshops where we've been teaching everything from how AI is applied in healthcare to topics like bias in AI.
So for our listeners, what exactly is AI?
That's a good question. I think there's two ways to define that. There is the high-level philosophical point of view, which is artificial intelligence is when you have computers doing things that we normally consider to be human. These are things like driving a car or writing a poem or even reading out loud or understanding or having a conversation. These can be defined as artificially intelligent. There's the more technical way of defining it, which is that artificial intelligence is a set of techniques that computer scientists have developed, which allow us to look for patterns in data to then mimic the same work that a human would do. And so the way that we would look at an image and pick out things is going to be different than the way that a computer can do it. But if we can get it to do it at the same level of competency that a human can do it, then we can refer to that as being artificial intelligence. But the key thing to remember here is that all of it is driven by vast amounts of data and finding patterns in those vast amounts of data. And that's really been the big learning that has driven the artificial intelligence revolution, is that we have learned how to go through and parse really large amounts of data and find learnings with it that we can then apply to build all sorts of cool new technology.
That sounds really exciting. However, I've read lots of articles and different reports lately that different technical organizations or companies are starting to find bias in AI. And I don't know if this is a good example, but I read an article in a UK publication that said that a company had created an automatic soap dispenser using artificial intelligence that ultimately would not dispense soap to dark hands. Can you tell us a little bit about how bias finds its way into artificial intelligence?
Sure, that's a really good question. And it's kind of confusing because you're thinking about it as this is a computer, it can't be biased. And it's a confusing thing to think about. And I think the way that we start to understand how it becomes biased is through that technical definition of AI, which is that it comes from learning from lots of data. And if your data is biased, it is going to learn those same biased decisions. I think early on in the AI revolution, there were some murmurings or some ideas that this was a way for us to step away from having bias. This was a way for us to step away from having bias in the decisions we're making. But a really good example is, let's say that I was trying to build some AI that was trying to figure out whether someone's going to make a good candidate for the president of the United States. The way that I would do that is to look for all the data that we have of people who have tried to become president and the people who have been successful at becoming president. And then I would use that to create a model that could predict how likely someone is going to be to become the president. And unfortunately, in our current world, if you look at a photo of all the presidents we've had, all but one have been white males. And so the likelihood of that model learning that someone who is a African-American female is going to become president is really low. And so the AI is going to learn the biases that already exist in the world out there. The second way that AI is going to become biased is just through the fact that we have humans who are building these systems. And when you're building them, there's no single way to build it. There are going to be some decisions that the implementer and the builder of AI is going to have to make, and some trade-offs that they're going to have to make. And the way that they make those trade-offs is through their own biased different perspective. And that's why increasing the amount of diversity of people who are building these tools is really important. And also increasing the understanding of AI to a more diverse crowd so that more people are able to talk about it and have conversations about it and help drive decisions around it is really important.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI.
You mentioned earlier that you've done some work or research in AI in healthcare. When I think about some of these algorithms that can be run in healthcare, like you said, in employment, that might end up being biased towards people of color, how can that be harmful to people of color?
There's a really good example of an algorithm that was being tested that was used to triage patients. When a patient comes into a hospital, especially an emergency room, the people there, the nurses and the doctors, have to make really quick decisions about who they attend to first and who they attend to next and who looks like they're going to be in an okay enough state where they can wait later. Basically try to figure out where they can put in their best efforts. And this is a decision period which is very critical, and there's a lot of information to take in and a really hard decision to make. All the more reason for someone to think, hey, let's build an AI tool that's going to solve this problem for the nurses and doctors. Unfortunately, what ended up happening was that that tool was actually diminishing the needs of the very sickest Black patients. And that was based on looking at a lot of the data of health outcomes in the past. And health outcomes historically have not been as good for marginalized groups because of the limited access that they already have. And so the AI is going to learn those same rules that already exist in society and end up prioritizing people who are part of a majority rather than a minority.
So you mentioned bringing more diversity into programmers, but what can big tech and the organizations that purchase this AI, you know, what can they do to mitigate this biased and ultimately, you know, racist decisions when, like you said, they are dealing with a lot of information and it's critical and it's time sensitive? It sounds like we need some AI to police the AI to police the AI. But all jokes aside, you know, what can we do moving forward?
I think the answer there comes down to regulation. And a lot of people get scared when they hear about regulation and they think about this as stopping innovation or making it harder for us to build things that are going to improve our world. But regulation is a common solution to problems like this. If you think about all the places in society where we know that there is potential for harm, the way we solve for it is by regulating. There's examples, for example, with lawyers, and you have to pass a bar association before you can practice law. That's a type of regulation. Medicine is the same way. There's other industries that require you to have a third-party assessment to prove that whatever you're doing is ethical or works the way it does or meets some set of guidelines before you're able to actually use it out in the world. And I think when it comes to organizations, it's going to be hard for any one organization to decide this is the standard and then hold up to that. That is not what those organizations are good at. Those organizations are good at innovating their solutions. So what they need to do is help educate and guide the government to building out the right regulation frameworks so that these decisions about what is allowed and what is not allowed and what should be done and what is ethical and what is not aren't left to a single founder or a single CEO or a single programmer at a company, but are instead decisions that can be made through regulations and decisions that are going to involve all of the citizens of that society. And that's why it's also important for all of us to understand what we mean when we're talking about AI and about bias in AI, so we can be part of that conversation and help drive towards a solution.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI.
Absolutely, I agree, because I'm not quite sure if I trust a big tech company that has internal bias issues with their own employees to the point where they fire prominent African-American programmers who are running and doing research in these ethics with AI, that they would put their profits aside and do what's best for society. So I agree with you that we as a community of people of color need to be aware of this issue. And I think a lot of our listeners will be surprised and intrigued. And I hope we'll start doing research that we can start advocating for ourselves. Is there anything else that you want to add?
I think the only thing I would add is that a lot of people have this perspective, and we find this when I work with AI for Anyone and we're going to schools or we're talking to people about the work that we do. A lot of people have the perspective that you need to be technical in some way to get involved in the conversations in this space. And that's not necessarily true, which is why that organization was formed to help you get basically that base level of understanding so that you can participate in these conversations. AI literacy is going to be as important as it might have been 20 years ago to understand what the internet was, or the way it might have been 10 years ago or 15 years ago to understand the implications of a smartphone. All of these things are going to impact us, whether we like it or not, over the next 20 years. And so we all need to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about AI, and then how we can be part of the solution around building AI for a better and fairer world for everybody.
Do you have a URL, website, or social media page to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I do. You can go to aiforanyone.org. That's just the letter A, the letter I, foranyone.org. And you can see some of the content that we have on there. We regularly do workshops that we host online now that you can attend or view some of the recordings of on YouTube. You can also sign up for our newsletter or see some of the blog posts we put out and help join the conversation. And if you're interested in volunteering, we're always looking for people who are interested in this space and looking to help drive towards a more AI literate world.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
So on this edition of Let's Talk About Race, the topic is racism in artificial intelligence. How does racism rear its ugly head, and how does it impact artificial intelligence? And what is artificial intelligence? Let's start with Althea. Althea, you're a news director. Break it all down.
Sure. So I'll go through some of the basics here. Artificial intelligence refers to computers doing things that normally require human intelligence. And so there is a really big range of things that that can include. And those programs, as they're being developed, can actually get bias in them at multiple stages in the process. And when we talk about bias or racism in artificial intelligence, that is when the models that are making predictions for, maybe it's something like your Netflix recommendation, or maybe it's something like who's going to be granted bail when they're in prison. Bias in artificial intelligence is when the model makes predictions that discriminate against groups of people, obviously. And there are certain applications of artificial intelligence that have more potential for harm than others, right? So artificial intelligence can be used for making all different kinds of predictions, right? Maybe it's about what you want to see on Netflix or some other streaming platform, but maybe it's making recommendations about who could be eligible for bail, or facial recognition technology being used by police stations to try to make arrest identifications. There are applications of artificial intelligence that have more potential for harm than other ones, and that's important to know. And in the process of building an AI model, there's a lot of things that go into it, and there's a bunch of different ways that bias can find its way in. For one, the data set that the algorithm is trained on can be biased information. For example, facial recognition software is much more successful, in fact, very successful, at identifying white men. But successful identifications for Black people, for Indigenous people, for people of color, and women are much at a much lower rate. And yet, many police stations, law enforcement facilities will use facial recognition, despite the fact that it is trained on a data set that is often made of white men.
Since 2016, Detroit has been using a surveillance system to monitor the city and track suspected criminals. It's able to identify individual citizens so well because it uses facial recognition based on over 50 million driver's license photos and mugshots. And people are angry, not just because this technology is seen as an invasion of privacy, but because the system doesn't seem to work. Multiple studies have shown that facial recognition is more likely to misidentify Black people than others. This is a major problem, but even more so in a city like Detroit, which has the highest percentage of Black residents than any other major U.S. city. In a police board meeting, a white woman said,
"If you're afraid of the cameras, either you're paranoid or you've got something to hide."
But this sentiment was proven incorrect when Detroit Assistant Chief of Police James White said that he was misidentified by Facebook's AI. And when the ACLU tested Amazon's facial recognition on members of Congress, not only did it misidentify 28 of them as criminals, but a disproportionate amount of the ones misidentified were people of color. These are just more examples of how algorithmic bias will continue to affect people of color in the future. When the system specifically frames you as a criminal, how are you supposed to survive? Plus, facial recognition has a nasty history of physiognomy, the practice of determining one's character based on nothing but their facial features. If you can be arrested just because an AI said that you looked like a criminal, then this is just the next evolution of stop and frisk. Chief White said that facial recognition is only used as a tool for investigation and never as the sole evidence for arrest. But can we really trust that this will continue to be the policy moving forward? Oakland recently followed San Francisco and Somerville, Massachusetts in banning the use of facial recognition by police, which has a greater impact because Oakland has a much larger Black population than the former two. And the city of Oakland specifically stated algorithmic bias as a key reason for the ban. We can only hope more cities follow suit, cities like Detroit or Chicago. As Detroit-based activist Tawana Petty said, "If we allow racially biased technologies to succeed here, then there really isn't any hope for Black residents anywhere else in the United States."
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI.
The teams behind a lot of artificial intelligence are made up of white men. So there are not necessarily like stopping points in the process that tell you, hey, is our data actually representative of what we are going to try to apply this artificial intelligence to? And they don't have people on their team who may be able to flag that for them, or they're hiring people from overseas to clean the data that can also introduce cultural biases there. And the thing to know about artificial intelligence is that it is trying to find the pattern in the data so that it can draw its own conclusions, essentially, with not a whole lot of context, saying, like, you want to have this output, and it's going to measure in its own way how to recognize a pattern to get as close to that output as it can. And so, really, if we're not thinking about bias in different steps of the process, it simply ends up being automated, and it's being used and not really regulated in a variety of different arenas that have a real impact on people.
Thank you for breaking it down. Let me bring Cecil into this conversation. So Cecil, my name is LaQuisha, and I'm looking for a job with IBM. So IBM sees my resume, LaQuisha or Becky. Does LaQuisha have a shot of getting her resume looked at as opposed to Becky?
Becky and even Karen has a better shot rather than LaQuisha. What we know is that artificial intelligence is based on human input. And so the data we put in determines the data that goes out. And if there are racial inequities and differences of identifying people, that is reflected in the way data is released. Another way in which we see this iniquity is not only in terms of example you gave about job application, but also we know so much now about how people of color communities are impacted by health disparities. In a recent study from the Journal of the American Medical Informatics Association points out that the global research community is also reflects prejudice and bias in what this research community puts out. It states, not properly addressed, propagating these biases under the mantle of AI has the potential to exaggerate the health disparities faced by minority populations already bearing the highest disease burdens. So the way in which the pandemic impact people of color is worsened by existing disparities in healthcare and systemic racism, which is amplified by AI and the way it is used.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI.
There are two ways that we can identify how sick a person is. One is how many dollars are spent on that person. You know, the assumption being the more healthcare they come in for, the more treatment that they get, the more dollars they spend, and presumably the sicker they are if they're getting all that treatment. And the other way is that, you know, we can measure actual biophysical things, you know, from lab tests, what kind of conditions or diseases they might have. So it seems like this algorithm was relying on the cost prediction definition. In other words, the more dollars a patient was projected to spend on the part of an insurance company or a hospital, then that was a sign of how sick they were going to be. And that seems to be where the bias emerged. So instead of relying on just costs to predict which patients are going to need follow-up care, they actually used biometric data, biophysical data, physiological data, and they saw a dramatic difference. You know, in the previous model, the algorithm missed some 48,000 extra chronic conditions that African American patients had. But when they rejiggered the algorithm to look more at actual biological data, they brought that down to about 7,700. So it was about an 84% reduction in bias. And the algorithm is used by hospitals to help them flag patients who might need extra care in the coming year, whether it's, you know, an at-home nurse or making sure that they come in for regularly scheduled doctor's appointments. So we can only presume that if Black patients, sicker Black patients, weren't being flagged accurately, that they also missed out on this follow-up care.
I want to bring in Professor Johnson, who has a background in employment. Professor Johnson, could you explore the idea of how AI is going to make sure Jamal doesn't get a job, whereas Stephen could get a job, or Kevin can get a job, or Justin?
It's an interesting question because many larger companies now have automated the recruitment process, and they pay a significant amount of money for recruiting technology because the number of applicants that actually can be handled. I've worked at a company where they might get 1,000 applications in one day. So they've kind of offloaded that initial sort through people who apply. It's based on keywords. And because technology really is more a process when it comes to recruitment than thinking, sometimes those keywords do not match applicants to the right jobs. And if you have ever been to any kind of training on how to write a resume, they always tell you to look at the job description, regurgitate those keywords. When we talk about discernment there about names, making assumptions about who people are, that kind of happens later in the process manually when people are actually have the resume and they're looking at the name. So there's two different kinds of biases that actually come into play when you're looking at recruitment. But from the AI focus, what I find concerning is how AI learns to read and select the most desired candidate. It's an issue of data. One of the examples that struck me had to do with using 10 years of data for a CEO job, for example. Well, in certain areas and certain fields, most of the people that were hired in those jobs might be male and white. And if that's what the AI learned from, then the bias is built into the selection process. And that, to me, is an important area. And thinking about how that affects the, how AI feeds into recruiting and selecting employees, and especially at those higher levels.
Many people around the world apply for jobs and then eagerly wait for an interview callback, but only a select few get that callback, and there are lots of factors which go into that, like experience. But a study out of Northwestern University found there may be another reason why some people aren't hearing back, and it has to do with race. Lincoln Quillian led the study, which took data from about 97 previously conducted field experiments looking at the hiring process in 9 countries. The data included fictitious resumes which held the same information but had different names. Some had ethnic-sounding names and others had non-ethnic names.
We found racial and ethnic discrimination against non-white groups was really quite ubiquitous across countries and across groups. So there were really no situations in which, you know, the majority members of the white group were more discriminated against than minority members were.
Quillian and his team measured discrimination by calculating the percent of interview callbacks an ethnic applicant had versus a non-ethnic applicant.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI.
The other comment I might make just briefly is the impact that AI can have on eliminating jobs, particularly in certain industries. In the distribution industry, I had personal experience with how distribution centers work, and the automation of that work results in a less labor-intensive kind of industry. FedEx Hub is a good example, where for the number, I think they fly in somewhere between 140 and 200 planes at night. They process 1.5 million packages every night, and there's really only 2 points of human contact, driving the lugs, that's what carries the packages from the plane to the conveyor belts, and then there is a human person that actually flips the package up to the right side so that the barcode reader can read the barcode. And if you think about where distribution would have been, where all those packages would have been unloaded by people, they probably would have sorted them out and put them in, you know, containers and sent them through the distribution center. There would have been a lot of manual contact, no longer required. So those are jobs that no longer exist.
The rise of robots has led to some pretty scary warnings about the future of work.
The robots will be able to do everything better than us.
A recent study found up to 670,000 U.S. jobs were lost to robots between 1990 and 2007, and that number is likely to go up. A widely cited study from 2013 found nearly half of all jobs in the U.S. are in danger of being automated over the next 20 years. Occupations that require repetitive and predictable tasks in transportation, logistics, and administrative support were especially high risk. And just think, robots don't need health benefits, vacation, or even sleep for that matter.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI.
We're going to move on to Michelle. This is her first show sitting in as part of the panelists. Michelle, who's the associate producer with Grassroot News, our tech person. You're kind of a tech geek. I don't mean to be offensive when I say that. Can you drill down how AI can be biased against people of color, against low-income people, and against women?
Well, there's a lot of moving parts to that answer, but it boils down to what's called natural language processing, and that's the interaction between computers and human language. In that field, you're looking at speech recognition, you're looking at language generation, as well as understanding. Looking at that field, that's where the linguistic models of the biases of having determining whether or not Jamal versus Kevin come in, because they prefer, based on their large data sets, whatever biased information that they're getting. One of the biggest things that happened recently is the firing of Timnit Gebru, and she was an AI ethicist.
They immediately terminated me in the middle of my vacation and did not even have my corporate access. I don't even know what events I've signed up for because I can't access my calendar. So he did not apologize for that. What he's sorry for, if you read the statement, is for the fact that this seeded doubts. He did not say we apologize for how we treated her and what we did. He is apologizing for the backlash that they are currently receiving. This is not an apology. Secondly, he talks about de-escalation strategies. For whom? I mean, I would appreciate de-escalation strategies for the managers and HR and legal people who decided to fire me, but certainly not for me, because I am not some sort of unreasonable, angry person who needs to be de-escalated or have some sort of strategy for. I'm a reasonable person you can have a conversation with.
Who worked and look into large data sets in language models and how biased they were, because they're taking in so much information from all over the internet.
I recently signed something, a letter against something called the Extreme Vetting Initiative. And this was an initiative proposed by ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement. What they were proposing was to partner with tech companies to analyze someone's social network activity to help them determine whether this person would be a good immigrant or not, whether this person's likely to commit a terrorist act or not, whether this person would be a good citizen. Now, I want to stop here and say there are two questions we can ask, right? The first one is whether or not we should have tools that are doing this in the first place. But the second question I want to address today is that the current AI tools, the automated tools that we have to do this task, are not robust enough to be used in such high-stakes scenarios.
Bias in AI favors wealthier countries who have the infrastructure. You talked about electricity, correct, laptops, whereas a developing country, which only has 4 hours of electricity a day, you don't, correct, have that option or that access, correct?
Correct. You can even see it during the pandemic here in America. You can see that communities that had greater access to that infrastructure, whose parents had the resources to have high-speed internet during this whole pandemic, their children had better outcomes because they were able to have those technical resources versus a lower-income family, mainly Black and Latino and Indigenous American. They don't have that constant income because, once again, bias in the workplace and looking at applicant tracking softwares, it skews harder towards white and white, I would say, facing cultures because they do have the preferred treatment. And it's something that is unfortunate because it's a style of what we would call digital redlining, where people who don't have access get fenced off from having access further down the road, because the inequality perpetuates itself. Because if you don't have access to technical resources, how are you going to be technically literate? And when most jobs are going towards more technical backgrounds, heavy in terms of coding, heavy in terms of understanding what these artificial intelligence, you know, the algorithms are doing, you're already set down the wrong path, where it's mainly manual labor. As you can see from most of the employees at Amazon are going to be Black and Latino, and that's manual labor and something that they're looking at robotics to assist and more than likely down the line get rid of to some extent. Looking at that entire ecosystem, you can see where the biases are starting to happen. So if you see that over time, people with less access to internet and infrastructures that help with technical resources, their data isn't as great as, say, people who do. So right there in the process, if you don't have people who are cognizant of that fact and look at it as, hey, let's look specifically at these communities of color and A, give them resources. And before then, let's look specifically at how their culture works, how language is interpreted from one person to another, which is going to be different from one culture to another. You're always going to have that implicit bias baked in.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet. You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI show.
Now we're talking about race and class. Yo, I'm a baby boomer. Let's talk about age discrimination, how AI impacts and reinforces age discrimination. I remember Facebook got in trouble because they would have job openings that they would only give to people under 35 to 21, male, white, and it excluded a whole bunch of folk. So not only does AI discriminate color and class, it also promotes age discrimination. Who wants to address that issue?
The Silicon Valley culture is that of you're exceptional when you're young. Like if you don't have your startup unicorn galloping around by the age of 25, then you're past your prime. It's a depressing outlook on life because it breeds this culture of perceived meritocracy, a perceived exceptionalism that as a young white male, you know, I've closed my whatever round of venture capital, you know, in high school. And now I'm out in Silicon Valley and I'm pitching my startup and now we're getting backing from, you know, Google per se. And if you don't fit within those boundaries, you're not seen as valuable, unfortunately. You're not seen as someone who has anything to bring to the table. It's an ecosystem that cannibalizes tech talent outside of what most founders look like, which is white and male. They're starting to make some ground in that, in the fact that there's a lot more venture capital organizations that are looking to outside sources because they know that they haven't exhausted all of their resources, but they're seeing that there's a huge gap in, say, ethics, because they're starting to see that a lot of these people where they don't mind the bravado of, you know, break whatever you have to break to make the money and make sure that the company runs. They're not looking at the human aspect and the impact of it. It's more of the intent. As long as the intent was good, it's fine and dandy. But as soon as the impact gets brought on board, the outlook isn't as rosy as they once thought.
I wanted to add on something that I think Michelle was opening up, and that's in terms of access. You mentioned the digital divide over generations, but it's also economics, it's also racial. What we have witnessed in these past few months when much of education has been online is the increased recognition that many poor communities, communities of colors, do not have access to basic technologies. They don't have access to a computer or an access to a pad or even the ability to have access to internet. So there's that divide. What we often see is also the lack of steering people, young people, into careers that will lead them to Silicon Valley. We don't see the emphasis on coding for poor and minority children. If we saw more, I don't know, coding boot camps as we have basketball camps, I think we would see a difference in the way many communities are transformed.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI show.
Professor Johnson, you want to chime in, and then I want to ask Althea a question. Professor Johnson?
Yes. In follow-up, Cecil is raising a really important point. If we want dimensions of diversity considered and addressed in AI, we have to have diverse people working in AI. And it was shocking to me that in the statistics I read in one article is that in 2016, of the 10 largest tech companies in Silicon Valley, they did not employ a single Black woman. And three of those companies didn't have any Black employees. The point that Cecil is making is critical. If we don't want to have these old archaic prejudices built into AI, we have to have diverse creators. I like this idea of AI ethicists and that role. And I think more emphasis needs to be placed on that by these tech companies. That is going to be part of the solution, is actually getting more people of color in those jobs.
Now, this entire topic was shepherded by Althea Billings, news director of Cable Radio. Althea, why was this topic important to you? Why did you want us to address it?
I think what got me interested in this topic, and you know, I wanted to hear from the panel about it, is because it touches so many parts of our lives, like parts of my life that I didn't even know was part of AI. And I think Michelle and Cecil both indicated this. For the layperson who's not involved in any part of the industry, this all seems pretty obtuse. You know, there's aspects of AI that I didn't know existed, and I didn't know how it was created to perform a task for me. And I want to say there are reasons to be excited about the idea of artificial intelligence, making certain tasks more efficient, redirecting our efforts towards different things. Like, there's reasons that that could be a good thing and can be used for good, but that it is something that is sort of running rampant right now. I felt it was important for us to address it. And I think there's a couple ways that it could be tackled if it wanted to be tackled, but I think we see that companies, as Michelle was indicating, don't really have a culture of caring about what their error rate is and what is their error rate and at whose expense does that kind of stuff happen. And also, government is way behind on regulating artificial intelligence and checking, creating any kind of industry standard. There's a lot of things that it could look like, but that it touches so many things, it influences decisions and has major impact on people's lives. And yet there isn't an understanding of how it is created and what is teaching it. And I think also there's an aspect that, oh, it's artificial intelligence. It's not related to humans. Whatever it says must be right. It's not influenced by our biases. That's obviously a pretty shallow narrative about it, but that's kind of, you know, at its face what people see in it. That it's not, how could it be biased? The computer made it. The computer was taught by humans. So we need to be aware of all of the things that we are valuing within the computer systems that are now governing our lives.
So this entire technology is about asking questions. That's what AI is in every industry, from criminal justice to healthcare to finance. Look at how systemic racism has plagued finance and credit scores and education and the redlining that we've seen that has now turned into digital redlining. And we've got to check ourselves. And we've got to question ourselves and saying, are we denying an entire, you know, demographic access to wealth because of the tools that we use when it comes to insurance or credit scores or who's getting a loan or who gets the mortgage? What are we doing? What are we doing? And we've got to ask ourselves, what is the meaning of citizenship? And if we are going to use an algorithm or a technology like AI that not only impacts your identity and gives you a digital identity, but also impacts the meaning of citizenship, the meaning of access, the meaning of justice, the meaning of identity, the meaning of belonging, all of those things have an impact on who we are and how we feel as citizens of a country, citizens of the world. And AI can change that either in a good way or it can challenge it in very negative ways. And it's really about future-proofing, I always say future-proofing, you know, looking at how we build a better tomorrow, but doing the work today.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Racism in AI show.
Any final thoughts on AI and racism? Can we ameliorate this situation? How do we address it? How do we combat it? Let's start with Michelle.
I would definitely say there's a wide variety of tactics to combat racism in AI. And I think one of the biggest things, and a trend that you'll probably start hearing, is what's called explainable AI. So as it stands right now, most of the, I would say, processing tools, what's doing the computations behind the scenes, are what's called black box models, where sometimes the human in the loop is really out of the loop and is unable to explain how the computer arrived at their conclusion, versus the new trend of, well, I'm hoping the new trend of explainable artificial intelligence will keep people in the loop at all steps so that they can see how the computer is processing the data, and if they see any biases within that computation, they can handle it on demand versus trying to walk backwards into how the computer derived that information and those assumptions. And I think that's one of the steps in the right direction. I would also say, looking at large data sets, how they're used within artificial intelligence. Just recently, Stanford and OpenAI published a paper saying they need to look at what's happening within these large data models, and that they are potentially harmful if certain actions aren't addressed with them. And which was unfortunately what Dr. Gebru was actually fired for. That was her research, that these things could lead to harm because of the biases that are intrinsic to data collection in and of itself.
Thank you. Cecil?
I think that we need to also address, as the other panelists asserted, the workforce. And what we have failed to address is that Silicon Valley, all the big firms now, are the 21st equivalent to 19th century robber barons. And that the workforce need to be organized. They are taking the tactics of ruthless corporations from the 20th century and preventing their workers to organize, to have a voice in terms of not only how they are paid, but their working conditions. So I think our important role in these coming years is how might workers be organized, and that's when they gain power, and that's when I think we'll begin to see a change in the direction and orientation of many of these newer corporations.
Thank you, Cecil. Professor Johnson, and then Althea.
One of the things that stands out for me is that these corporations have not seen the importance to their bottom line of taking into consideration diversity. That's what I think will get their attention. And that example, I guess, that became something funny on the internet about how technical concepts created a soap dispenser that didn't recognize or wouldn't dispense soap to black hands because everybody that developed that product was white, was based on infrared, and dark skin absorbs more light, so it wouldn't dispense the soap. That's a bottom line issue. You've created a product that has no use, not in the public anyway, in a general sense. And that's where you get their attention on the importance of having a diverse team in the development process, as well as other parts of the corporation. Now, that one was kind of silly, but when you think about driverless cars don't recognize black pedestrians, that's not silly, that's dangerous.
Great examples. Althea, final words.
Sure. When we think about solutions, there's solutions that can happen within the industry. There's also solutions that can come from government. For one example I wanted to note was that in 2020, Portland, Oregon passed a law banning facial recognition software to be used by law enforcement agencies, which is pretty major, like very sweeping ban. Not much in the way of loopholes there, which is fortunate. But one thing I want to highlight is the interpersonal aspect. Talking about this, understanding it a little bit better does make a difference. And because so much of our life is now online, both as a result of progress and as a result of the pandemic, there's even more ways that algorithms, artificial intelligence play in. And so whether that's your social media apps or it's platforms that you use for work, those are influenced by algorithms. So I think also thinking about not putting blind trust into those things, asking questions about it, learning where your data is at, how it's being used, what you're being marketed towards, that's a bigger conversation. But being aware of how you as an individual factors in and how the people around you do as well.
One thing I want to bring up was a recommended reading list for anybody who's really wanting to know more about AI and how it affects their lives day to day. One of my favorite books, I would say, would be The Algorithms of Oppression by Sophia Noble. I would definitely also check out Automating Inequality by Virginia Eubanks, and also Artificial Unintelligence by Meredith Broussard. Those three books are a pretty good primer on what it looks like within the world of AI and how those biases can crop up at any time using any media online.
Joy Bulimwini has been researching prejudice in tech, and her work is on show in this new exhibition at London's Barbican.
So this is the experience I had that kind of started it all. Yeah. I was a grad student at MIT working on a project that used face detection, and you saw it work well on my friend's face.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.